You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. A new attorney general will lead to new priorities. How should and might Merrick Garland's Department of Justice confront hate crimes and terrorism? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The Department of Justice has a new head with the confirmation of Merrick Garland as attorney general. One of Garland's strengths is his experience and involvement in the successful prosecution of terrorism in the United States, most notably with Timothy McVeigh's attack on the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. How much should and will the Department of Justice focus on domestic terrorism, and how might this campaign proceed? Our guest is Chuck Rosenberg. He is senior counsel at Kroll and Mooring's Washington, D.C. office and a member of the firm's White Collar and Regulatory Enforcement Group. He served as the acting administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration and as chief of staff and senior counselor to FBI Director James Comey. Chuck Rosenberg, thank you for joining us. First off, Garland's background in the prosecution of terrorism in the United States was cited as one of the reasons why President Biden nominated him. How do you imagine a Department of Justice led by Merrick Garland might change what the DOJ's position has been recently on prosecuting terrorism?
Well, I hope he'll do a couple of things, Doug. And by the way, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to join you. I hope he'll do a couple of things. I hope he'll pay a lot of attention to this. We've always had a terrorism problem in this country, and by that I mean a domestic terrorism problem. We've always had hate groups. You know, we've always had these vile individuals who live in the shadows of our society. Never before has a president of the United States, in this case a former president, given sustenance to these groups. And so they are, I am afraid, more prevalent. They are emboldened, and it's going to take a lot of time and attention and resources to push them back into the shadows of American life. And so I think Merrick Garland, as you said, brings some experience with these types of groups and these types of cases. He also has an FBI that understands the problem well and has been working it for years. And I think it can use a shift in resources and more attention.
What does that mean in practical terms, in the sense that the acts committed by these groups are themselves crimes? So prosecuting them as crimes of terrorism or crimes of hate, and we can differentiate the two of those in just a moment, how does that differ from just prosecuting based on the violence of the act?
Yeah, it's a great question, and actually one that's very relevant right now. There actually is no federal crime of domestic terrorism. There is a federal crime related to international terrorism. For instance, providing material support, personnel, money, supplies, training to a designated international terrorist group, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the like. There is no analogous federal crime for domestic terrorism. And so take an example. Dylan Roof, a neo-Nazi white supremacist in 2015, kills 9 Black Americans in their church in Charleston, South Carolina. To your point, it's a crime. It is a state crime of murder. Murder is illegal in all 50 states. And so we don't have difficulty finding a crime to prosecute these people. We sometimes have difficulty finding a federal crime to prosecute them. And so my view is that we ought to have a domestic terrorism crime in the federal code, because there's a moral equivalency gap. We ought to call these people exactly what they are, not just murderers, that's a state thing by and large, but also terrorists, which I think ought to be a federal thing.
And sort of at the core of this then is the question of the intentionality of the act, that the murder is the crime, but should there be greater attention, greater sentencing, et cetera, if the murder was to serve a political purpose or some, you know, purpose driven by hate?
Sure. So you could imagine a scenario coming out of the January 6th riot at the Capitol, where a couple of things are happening simultaneously. You know, several different crimes are being committed. They're assaulting a police officer. They've murdered a police officer, but they've also stormed the Capitol in order to interfere with the electoral count. And so one act, the one we easily understand, the murder of a police officer, is a crime. The other was motivated perhaps by an ideology that we loathe or don't quite fully comprehend, but was intended, you know, to overthrow the outcome of a fair election, or was intended to thwart the government or interfere with its operations. You have to look at the intentionality. You're 100% correct. Sometimes more difficult to discern, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't have a statute on the books to criminalize it in federal court.
And then would that typically result in longer sentences, or just is the question what we're actually calling what's criminal?
Well, I think both. Again, going to my point about the moral equivalency gap, I think we ought to call terror exactly what it is, terror. Dylann Roof, in my view, is a terrorist. In the eyes of the law, he is a murderer under South Carolina code. In my world, in the world in which I lived, and you introduced me as someone who worked at the FBI and at the DEA, I was also a federal prosecutor for many, many years in the Eastern District of Virginia, both as an assistant U.S. attorney and as the United States attorney. I think what we call somebody matters a lot. You know, the murder victims of Dylann Roof are victims of terrorism. I think that's important. Dylann Roof is a terrorist. I think that's important. But technically, under federal law right now, we don't have that statute. And so to your question, what we call them matters and how we sentence them matters. So let's go back to your question about, you know, what are the consequences of being a terrorist? One is that we label someone. The labels matter. Dylann Roof is a terrorist. The other is that there are sentencing enhancements based on whether or not perhaps you targeted somebody based on race or nationality or religion or gender, or that if you acted out of an attempt or an ideology to overthrow the United States government, there could be sentencing enhancements. All that could be part of the sentencing scheme. So I think it matters for both of those reasons to signal loudly and clearly that these people are terrorists and their acts are terrorist acts, and to make sure that punishment is enhanced when you act in that way.
Now, when I think of federal statute focused on terrorism, my own background in international relations, I have a specific image in mind. And kind of what's central in that is the role of organization, that the Department of Justice and specifically the FBI viewing these acts, not necessarily as isolated incidents, but wanting to understand that there's some sort of an organization attached to that. So ultimately, I guess two related questions. The first is how central should unearthing the organization be versus the actual prosecution of each of these cases? And secondly, how does that alter the way that we view each individual case if there's actually some sort of a group that the person is working with?
Right. So you want to understand all of that. You want to understand if there is an organization, how it's funded, where their members are, where they reside, where they act, where they work, and how different parts of the organization may connect with one another. Really important stuff. However, that said, you also have lone wolves, lone actors. Some people might be motivated by the ideology of an organization, but not be a part of it. They might have read their hateful literature online and picked up a weapon and gone and hurt or killed somebody as a result. And the organization doesn't even know about this person or that they inspired them in some way. In some ways, it's the difference, if I can use an international terrorism analogy, it's the difference between Al-Qaeda, a very hierarchical organization with orders and plans and operations and strategy that come top down, and ISIS, which basically franchises terror and using social media encourages its adherents and followers to simply kill in its name. They don't care who does what on behalf of ISIS, as long as they do something on behalf of ISIS. So Al-Qaeda has that central hierarchical structure, and ISIS does not. They're both virulent and dangerous terrorist organizations.
I would imagine then one of the core questions here is a law enforcement question, that if the focus on prosecuting domestic terrorism is at least partially focused on the organizations that are attached to that, understanding those organizations, breaking up those organizations becomes a powerful deterrent mechanism. Perhaps the most important thing about being a part of that organization is that, or is it more about the nature of the prosecution themselves, the types of sentences that could potentially be handed down?
Well, so if you're asking me with my federal prosecutor hat on, I would say the second thing, right? Dismantling the organizations and holding their members accountable for their acts. That said, a lot of these organizations also find themselves on the wrong end of civil lawsuits brought by aggrieved citizens, and properly so. And so if the organization has assets, they have a meeting house, they have property, they have a bank account, they have something, you know, sort of tangible, and they lose a civil suit, that's something that, you know, private citizens can win, can be awarded. So there's lots of different ways to attack them. Some on the civil side and through private litigation, some on the criminal side when the U.S. attorney, or in some cases, the state brings a criminal action. But to your point, Doug, understanding the organization is absolutely critical. Now, again, members may freelance, others may, or non-members may simply be inspired, but it's always really important to understand the organization and how it funds itself and how it operates and how it communicates. Because as a prosecutor, I'm also looking for a conspiracy. I'm looking for concerted conduct. I'm looking to see if two or more people agreed to do something that the law forbids. Because conspiracy prosecutions can be very powerful. It sweeps in lots of conduct over lots of time from lots of different people. And it is a in the prosecutor's quiver, it is a very important arrow.
Is the statute that would empower prosecutions under these conspiracies, is this the RICO statute, you know, that was used to help to break up organized crime?
It could be, theoretically. I mean, there's lots of conspiracies in the federal criminal code. And RICO is a bit of a complex and cumbersome statute because there are certain prerequisites you'd have to prove in court, but a very, very powerful tool to your point. I was actually thinking of a simpler conspiracy statute in the federal code. Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 371, is the general conspiracy statute. If you conspire with another person to violate any other federal law, that is a violation of the statute I just cited. And using that, you have advantages in terms of adducing proof, in using co-conspirator statements, and in sweeping in lots of conduct to prove the crime. So your point about RICO is a really important one, and that is a tool, but there are also very powerful general conspiracy statutes that can help a prosecutor in this case.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the Department of Justice prosecuting terrorism, extremism, and hate crimes with Chuck Rosenberg. Chuck was the acting administrator of the Drug Enforcement Agency and the chief of staff and senior counselor to FBI Director James Comey. I'd like to also draw upon your expertise on a couple of process questions. The first, you have a background experience as a federal prosecutor. How much independence do each of the individual prosecutors or the different offices have from the Attorney General and from the central leadership in the Department of Justice? Is there a lot of discretion given to the federal prosecutors, or is it pretty closely directed by the Attorney General?
Both, depending on the case. So in your average case, a bank robbery, a crime of violence, a fraud, the prosecutors in the field, the assistant U.S. attorneys, and I was one, have enormous discretion, and properly so. The Department of Justice, both in terms of prosecutors and agents, is a deployed army, if you will, Doug. The overwhelming majority of the work gets done in the field. And it would be, it's inconceivable that an attorney general could manage other than a very, very, very small fraction of it. So why did I say both? Because on the highest profile cases, on the most significant matters, the attorney general will be briefed regularly and will want to talk to the United States attorney in the field to understand how the case is progressing, or if more resources are necessary, or to weigh in on charging decisions. But an attorney general, any attorney general, can only do that in a small fraction of the thousands and thousands of cases that are brought around the country.
And also, and this, you know, came up in a segment last week talking about the independence of the attorney general from the presidency itself. How much independence does the Department of Justice have? And is it correct to say that the recent trend was to move against the independence of the Justice Department, and that there's an expectation that under Merrick Garland, the Justice Department is going to try to assert a bit more independence than, say, his previous couple of predecessors under President Trump?
That's such an important question, and I'm really glad you asked me that. So first, the Department of Justice by design, has an extraordinarily thin political layer, which is actually a very good thing, not a bad thing. And I often ask people when they ask me about this issue, whether they know how many people work at the FBI, and many don't, but the answer is 37,000 or so. And then I ask, how many of those 37,000 do you think are politically appointed? And they're often surprised to hear the answer, which is one, just one. In the US attorney community, and I was an assistant US attorney and the US attorney, in every US attorney's office in the country, there is at most one political appointee. And so by design, it is a career prosecutor, career agent heavy organization. So does the attorney general have independence? Should the attorney general have independence? What did it normally look like? Were the last 4 years aberrational? It's a complicated answer, but I think I can sort of summarize it in the following way. If you're talking about the criminal enforcement mechanisms of the United States Department of Justice, who is investigated, who's charged, who's prosecuted, who's tried, who's sentenced, the Department of Justice must have independence. It's so, so dangerous if it does not. And we saw in the previous administration, the president, you know, calling out enemies and favoring allies and issuing pardons on behalf of allies, and the attorney general weighing in on cases being litigated in the field to favor allies of the president. Extraordinarily damaging, extraordinarily dangerous. On the other hand, the attorney general is a member of the president's cabinet, and he is a subservient official to the president within the executive branch. And so properly answers to the president on questions of policy and the like. So is there a legitimate role for the Justice Department and the White House and the president to interact? Absolutely. On policy, on legislation, on the appointment of judges and the like. But when you talk about independence of the United States Department of Justice, what you're really asking, I think, Doug, and the most important thing is the independence of the criminal enforcement work. If that gets corrupted, we're all in danger. And I often say, we have to be two things in the Department of Justice. We have to be actually fair, and we have to be perceived as actually fair. If you're only one of those two things, you're losing. And I think in the last 4 years, the Department of Justice was perceived as not being actually fair, even if it was. And again, because the overwhelming majority of the work gets done in the field, I am completely confident that the overwhelming majority of the work was actually fair. But when we see the president and the attorney general interfering in certain high profile cases, we lose faith in the system. And that is deeply distressing.
And along the similar vein, one relationship that has certainly come under greater scrutiny is the relationship between the Department of Justice and specifically the attorney general and the FBI. I know with James Comey's memoirs, this issue has certainly come to a head in really the recent week to 10 days. The current FBI director has been very much asserting an FBI's independence rather than being tied to previous administrations. So I guess first is exactly how independent is the FBI from the attorney general? And has that relationship altered in recent years?
Well, so if you look at the organizational chart, the answer is in black and white. The Attorney General runs the Justice Department. The number two person will be Lisa Monaco. The Deputy Attorney General is the Chief Operating Officer on a day-to-day basis. And then the DEA and the ATF and the Marshal Service and the Bureau of Prisons and the FBI are all component agencies within the Department of Justice. And so the director of the FBI reports to the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Could not be more clear. But this goes back to the thing we just discussed. Are the political appointees, and both the Deputy Attorney General and the Attorney General are typically political appointees, whether it's a Republican or Democratic president, interfering in the criminal enforcement work of the FBI? Because that's where it gets dangerous. The FBI, and I worked there twice, once on the staff of Jim Comey and once on the staff of Bob Mueller right after 9/11, prides itself on its independence. That is true to an extent, but it is not a truly independent organization. It's part of the Justice Department, and the director, like the person who runs ATF or DEA, answers to political superiors. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. They just can't interfere in the criminal enforcement work for improper reasons. I know Chris Wray, the current director of the FBI. Chris is a good and decent and smart and honorable man, and I think he's leading the FBI in the right way.
If you were recommending to Merrick Garland what should be the priorities of the new Department of Justice, in particular on these issues of the prosecution of extremism, of hate crimes, et cetera, what would be some of your recommendations?
Well, you know, I read recently or reread recently the statement he gave to the Senate Judiciary Committee before his confirmation hearing. And he said himself that he's going to focus on terrorism, both in its international and domestic flavors and in civil rights enforcement. And also he's going to seek to restore morale in the Department of Justice, which I think took a hit, and reinforce norms, including what we just talked about, to make sure that there's no interference from the president or White House officials in their enforcement work. I think he has his priorities exactly right. It may make sense to shift some resources to the FBI, perhaps, or to seek more resources for the FBI to make sure that it has what it needs to fully investigate domestic terrorism cases. I also wouldn't be shocked if the Attorney General, and I would recommend this because that was your question, sought legislation to close that gap we had talked about earlier, that moral equivalency gap, so that there is a domestic terrorism statute in the federal code. The other thing, though, Doug, that I've noticed, and I've worked for many different attorneys general, including on the staff of two of them, is that whatever priorities they set almost always get overtaken by events, things they never could have envisioned. It's an exceedingly difficult job. And so, you know, I think Mike Tyson's line about having a fight plan until you get punched in the mouth applies here. It's a very difficult job. Things change rapidly. At the outset, it's good to have a vision for what you want to do and to articulate that vision to your the men and women in your department. But things will change. They always do.
And then speaking of which, two ways in which the Justice Department has been punched in the mouth by events. And I'd love to get your thoughts on these as sort of a last question. The first is the priority of prosecuting those who participated in the January 6th attack on the Capitol, and then the attacks, the murders in Atlanta this week. The first, clearly, Department of Justice plays a significant role. The second one is kind of an interesting question. Should the Department of Justice play a significant role? What do you imagine, and what would you recommend that the Attorney General's office do in those two high-profile cases?
Let's take the second one first, the heinous attack in Atlanta, the murder of Asian American citizens. I don't think exclusively Asian American citizens were murdered, but certainly the majority of the victims were Asian American. Whether or not the Department of Justice ends up prosecuting that case, they absolutely should be investigating that case. They should be giving whatever help, resources, personnel that they can to state and local partners. They should be looking to see if it was, in fact, a hate crime. As we speak, Doug, I don't think that we know that yet, but we absolutely have to look at it. It's a horrific murder, a horrific set of facts. If it turns out to be a hate crime, there are federal statutes that can be employed to bring the case into federal court and to prosecute the defendant federally. If it turns out not to be motivated by their race or nationality, it's still a murder and can be prosecuted in the state courts of Georgia, much like Dylann Roof was prosecuted in the state courts of South Carolina. So, you know, should the Justice Department be involved? Absolutely at the investigative phase and possibly at the prosecutive phase, depending on how facts develop. With respect to the riot at the Capitol, you see a massive federal response. I believe that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, and I don't have the latest number, but has charged more than 300 people. They're looking at conspiracies, which we talked about earlier. They're looking at all different sorts of lone wolves and individual actors. They're following the money. They're looking at the structures. They're looking at communications. My sense, as somebody who used to be in the Justice Department, but now watches it and admires it from the sidelines, is that they're doing it right.
We've been discussing the priorities of the Merrick Garland Department of Justice, in particular, the emphasis on prosecuting terrorism and hate crimes. Our guest has been Chuck Rosenberg. He is senior counsel in Kroll & Moring's Washington, D.C. office and a member of the firm's white-collar regulatory enforcement group. He served as the acting administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration and as the chief of staff and senior counselor to FBI Director James Comey. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.